Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCain. Congress just authorized $8 billion to be spent addressing the coronavirus outbreak. It reminds us that one of the most important activities of our Congress is to put together a budget. Where does our tax money go? And what would a budget look like that puts people first? Our first guest today, Ashiq Sadiq, has helped create a national budget that reflects the priorities of we the people. He'll be followed by our second guest, Rio Tazewell from People for American Way, talking about democracy reform. First up is Ashiq Sadiq, a research analyst for the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he analyzes the federal budget and military spending. He is the co-editor of The Poor People's Moral Budget. Ashiq Sadiq, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm excited you're here to talk with us. This is a big topic you've covered. There's very few people that can say they've actually helped to write a federal budget for the United States, but you're one of them. Can you tell us, you know, I read your budget. I think it's very impressive. And I'd love for you to share with our listeners, what are the key elements that you put together in this budget?
Yeah, absolutely. So the point of this budget was to work with a network called the Poor People's Campaign to basically lay out what it would actually take to eliminate poverty in the United States, as well as really tackle what the Poor People's Campaign calls the intersecting evils of systemic racism, poverty, militarism, and ecological devastation, which builds on the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., who identified three of those as just the main obstacles to tackle in society, which were racism, poverty, and militarism. And the current Poor People's Campaign identified ecological devastation as something that they think he also would have been very concerned about today if he were still alive. So, Poor People's Moral Budget really starts with the framing that in the United States today, there are 140 million people who are poor or just one emergency away from being poor. A lot of the time, people in both parties, when they talk about the economy, they talk about how it impacts middle-class people. But that really, like for the past few decades, has just left out almost a third of Americans who are living in or near poverty. So this budget breaks down over the course of over 100 pages, seven critical areas of the Poor People's Moral Agenda. One is democracy and equal protection under the law. Two is domestic tranquility. Three is peace and the common defense. Four is life and health. Five is the planet. Six is our future. And seven is an equitable economy. And each of these sections includes a bunch of policies to tackle over 40 demands that the Poor People's Campaign has for specific policies, including things like universal health care, including reaching zero emissions and transforming our infrastructure to clean energy, voting rights, all these things that would improve conditions for poor and working people in the United States today. So there's a lot in here that builds directly on the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., who in his lifetime was advocating things like a job guarantee, lifting poverty wages, and something like a universal basic income, like restoring the safety net, not just protecting it from the attacks that it's been under from conservatives in the past few decades, but expanding it so that it really is functioning as a safety net for all people. In each case, in each section, we found that our country has abundant resources to meet the demands of the poor and to address these widespread and systemic injustices we face. And meanwhile, the current realities of voter suppression and low inconsistent wages, insecure access to health care and other basic needs, wealth inequality, war, climate change, like the cost of these things that are already happening is much higher than the cost of just addressing them head on. So that's really the point of this entire thing, to show how we could pay for these policies, but to really emphasize that the cost of not doing anything on them and just letting these systemic forces continue to get worse and worse is just far greater than actually having proactive federal policies that can deal with them.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, you've said a lot of important things there, but one of them is I want to underscore for our listeners that we now are in a situation where, you know, it's not just that there's a handful of poor people in the country, it's that really many millions of people are dealing with economic insecurity, and we've got really a third of the Americans are poor or near poor now, and a lot of class slippage. People who used to be middle class or working class, you know, kind of lost their homes in the Great Recession or lost their jobs. So there's actually, instead of a growing circle of prosperity, we have a growing circle of economic insecurity. So when you're talking about dealing with the poor people's budget, it's really not just about poor people. Your budget is a fantastic budget for all of America, and it's how we, the people, can come together and address the issues that we're all facing. And as one of what we do is we can eliminate poverty. So I love what you've done, and I just want to make sure none of our listeners dismiss your work or your budget because they say, well, that's for about poor people, and I'm worried about myself not rescuing poor people. It's like, well, no, really, it's a budget for all of us and what we can do as a nation to move forward together. So thank you for putting together such a sensible budget, and you're absolutely right. We've got the resources to meet all our needs. It's just right now those resources are being directed in a way that, you know, it benefits mostly the wealthy corporations and wealthy individuals. But so let's talk a little bit about some of the elements you've got. You're talking here about a Green New Deal, which is awesome, where we could talk a little bit about what is the Green New Deal and what in your budget, what would we do about the climate crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. So so this report was published last June in 2019, and I think at the time, a lot of the national discussion we really started to have in a very mainstream way around the Green New Deal has really blown up in a way that I think is really exciting and positive. But at the time that we were compiling this report, we weren't necessarily referring to it as the Green New Deal. We were talking to a lot of folks who work in climate policy and economic policy about what aggressive climate policy would look like. But I think the framing of the Green New Deal is something that we weren't calling it at the time. So I just want to note that since, like, if you're reading the report now, you know, almost a year later, we don't use the term Green New Deal, but I think everything we're talking about is extremely aligned with that framework. And just because we published it last June, there were a bunch of things that we knew that by the time we published it might be out of date. Like there might be new findings, both in terms of climate science and also in terms of you know, economic cost and analysis that might outdo what we were calling for. So climate policy is actually one of the pieces of this moral budget that is, like if we were doing this today, we would incorporate a lot of new stuff that's come out that is even more ambitious than what we're calling for in this report. So in this report, we talk about $200 billion a year in investment in a clean energy transition, which would create 2.7 million net new jobs in updating our energy systems to be clean and renewable energy like solar and wind and other forms that are not fossil fuels, and also investing $37 billion a year in water infrastructure to create like almost a million new jobs while providing safe drinking waters to thousands of communities that don't have it. And these are really big numbers, but that number I just gave you for water infrastructure is less than what the Pentagon awards to just one corporation, Lockheed Martin, for military contracts in 2018. So like just throughout this report, we want to emphasize that we're talking about really big numbers in the billions or trillions, but we want to keep pointing out that we're already spending enormous amounts of money on things that are actually harming public safety and security while letting these fundamental needs go unmet. So so I said that the numbers we have here are somewhat out of date. In the past year, there have been a bunch of new studies that point to the cost of switching our entire energy grid to renewable energy in 10 years would cost $4.5 trillion. over the course of 10 years. So that's about $450 billion per year, which is a lot of money, but we constantly point to the trade-off of how much we have already spent as the United States government on war in the past 20 years, which is at this point $6.4 trillion over the course of 19 years since 2001, since 9/11. We've spent over $6 trillion on waging these really catastrophic wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and North Africa that just, you know, have destroyed those societies and led to countless of lives lost there and of U.S. troops. And it's just made the entire world more dangerous and insecure. So if we had started funding a clean energy transition in 2001, we could just have a 100% renewable energy grid already for less money than we've spent on war. So that is one element that if we could update this report now, we would really center that because it just really shows how skewed our priorities are at, toward militarism at a point when we need to be investing as much as possible in tackling the climate crisis while also improving the lives of most people. Like, and that's another thing that we really want to get across, that actually dealing with the climate crisis isn't just going to be very expensive with no benefits in the near term. It'll actually create tons of jobs. It'll actually, you know, provide more reliable access to energy and, you know, lower people's energy bills in the near term. So there, basically it's just a huge economic project that will actually make the day-to-day lives of most people better in the near term if it's structured in ways that really center jobs.
Right, exactly. Well, your basic premise on your budget still stands, that we could take and redirect some of the money that we've thrown into weapons and war, the $6.4 trillion you're talking about in the past 19 years, and redirect that to take care of what we need here at home in the United States. And we could rebuild our roads and bridges. We could build that clean energy network on renewable energies that we need to replace fossil fuels. We could expand public transportation with buses and trains and light rail to you know, make it so people don't feel so dependent on the fossil fuel cars that they're driving. All of that stuff we could take care of. It's just we've got the resources. We're just putting it into the military. Now, the thing of it is, we know that even though people want the roads and bridges and clean energy, they also want a strong military because of all the danger that we feel in the world. So what do you say to the critics who say, well, it's a dangerous world, and even though we're sacrificing some of these other things that we desperately need at home, we need to do it because number one job of the federal government is to keep us safe, and don't we need to prioritize that military spending?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and we want to tackle that, you know, answer that question as directly as possible. So one really important question when talking about our military budget is just, what is it actually funding? Is it actually, you know, keeping us safe? Is it actually supporting our troops? So we say no to both of those, because right now about half of the entire military budget, which is approaching $750 billion per year, goes to private contractor corporations that are providing all these services for the Pentagon, but like really marking up the cost, and they're just charging a lot more for things that are not even there just is not very much open discussion in Congress about what is actually necessary. So there are all these weapon systems that cost tens of billions of dollars and often, you know, have really just crazy malfunctions and things like that. Like the F-35 jet is often pointed to as this just multi-billion dollar boondoggle. So there are just all these things like that in the military budget that are more expensive because of contractors. And contractors get any like from 4 to 5 times as much of the military budget as the troops do. So soldiers themselves are getting a fraction of the military budget. Meanwhile, all these private corporations are getting paid way more. and a lot of their profits are just going straight to the CEOs of those companies. So these are companies like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing. So it's just a really perverse incentive for these companies to just keep charging more and more for the profits of their managers. And there's just this, they just have a lock on Congress because of all their lobbying. So, just because of that incentive, the military budget just keeps going up and up every year, more and more. And at this point, the U.S. has the largest military budget in the world by far. It's bigger than the next seven countries combined. Our moral budget calls for cutting it in half, almost in half, by $350 billion. And if we did that, we would still have a bigger military budget than China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea combined. So, we think it's definitely possible to keep the U.S. Safe and, like, people of the world safe. We think it would actually be safer if the U.S. had a smaller military budget, because so much of what the budget funds also is things like overseas military bases. We have over 800 foreign military bases in other countries. That's way, way more than any other country does. The next country, I can't remember offhand if it's Russia or China, has only 20 foreign military bases. We have over 800. So just the billions and billions of dollars, the tens of billions of dollars we spend on maintaining these overseas bases and stationing troops there, just makes it more likely that they'll be used for any kind of presumed conflict. And this is a major factor that leads to Congress or the president just, like, being very willing to use military force to deal with crises or situations around the world that aren't well solved with military solutions. They could be better solved with diplomacy or, you know, other kinds of foreign aid that help make societies more resilient. But the U.S. has just pursued this military policy for decades now of just, you know, just intervening in ways with military force without paying very much attention to the long-term consequences of using that kind of force. So there's just been this repeated pattern for decades now of the U.S. Using its military to make to spread violence, basically, and just make societies around the world more unstable, and to increase resentment of the United States in a lot of societies. That also makes the world less safe, and less safe for people living in the United States, because the U.S. is using this policy of violence rather than pursuing diplomacy and cooperation, which is something we really need in the context of the climate crisis, right? Where it's a global crisis, and the solutions to it have to be global and involve a lot of cooperation. So pursuing this very militarized foreign policy with this giant bloated military is a major obstacle to the kind of international cooperation we need to decarbonize the economy and make sure, you know, we're actually spreading prosperity for everybody in the world.
Right, exactly. Well, you've raised a lot of important points there, and you mentioned that half of the military budget is going to the private contractors who charge outrageous amounts of money. I mean, we've all heard about the $1,000 toilet seats and all that kind of stuff. And by the way, we've got Eric Prince, who was the CEO of Blackwater, which is one of those major private contractors, was just exposed as training some of the right wingers in how to infiltrate the liberal groups like the unions and other nonprofit organizations. So they're scary people, some of these characters that the federal government's been funding billions and billions of dollars to. And, you know, it's really stunning when you look at the amount of money we, the American taxpayer, are paying into the military. Yes, we want a strong military, but do we really need to pay more money than, what is it, the next 10 other countries combined? I mean, it's just, you know, outrageously high there, $750 billion a year. What do you think would be a reasonable amount that, you know, obviously we want to have a strong national defense, but how much do you think would be a reasonable amount to pay for defense as long as we're also bringing in some of these other, you know, things like trying to respond with diplomacy instead of with missiles whenever there's a disagreement?
Yeah, so that's a key part of this report. We're calling for a military budget cut of $350 billion per year. And again, the current budget is approaching $750 billion. So we're calling to basically cut it in half. And a lot of that is stuff that we identify as either not necessary or actually harmful. So that's stuff like closing 60% of the foreign bases I referred to. There are over 800 of them. So if we closed 60%, we would still be left with something like 300 foreign bases. And again, the next country only has around 20. So that would save us $90 billion. Ending the wars that we have ongoing right now in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and elsewhere, and bringing the troops home would save us $66 billion. Cutting unnecessary weapon systems would save us about $60 billion. If we cut overhead, just a huge chunk of the military budget is just administrative bloat, like bureaucracy. So cutting overhead by 10% would save us $27 billion. Reducing military research and development by 10% would save us about $10 billion, and that's money that could be used for all sorts of other civilian research and development, and like, again, just emphasizing climate change, like there are all these technological solutions that already exist that show us how to decarbonize our economy, but they just aren't funded enough to really deploy them so everyone can benefit from them. Another thing is dismantling nuclear weapons, which, you know, people don't talk so much about, banning nukes as they did, you know, during the 80s. Maybe I think that was the last time that was really in public consciousness. But nuclear proliferation is, you know, as much of an issue as it ever was. Like, more and more countries around the world are trying to keep up with the U.S.'s continued funding of nuclear weapons. Under President Obama, there was a huge deal to, quote-unquote, modernize the existing nuclear arsenal by pouring billions more dollars into just basically creating more nuclear weapons when the U.S. already by far has the most nuclear weapons in the world. So if we started to take serious steps to reduce our nuclear arsenal and, like, again, use diplomacy to encourage other countries to stop pursuing that policy of proliferation, that would be about $43 billion. So all these are things that are parts of our current military budget that are making us less safe and just encouraging other countries to get more and more militarized in a way that makes it more likely that there's going to be more military conflict around the world. So by cutting down on these things, we think there would be a lot of money to fund all the other things we're talking about that provide the kind of security that we think really matters, which is stuff like housing, public health, public education, clean air and water, actual diplomacy. Like to put the military budget in perspective, we're spending much less than $50 billion on the State Department and diplomacy than we are on the military budget, which is approaching $750 billion. So just by funding militarization so much more than we're funding diplomacy, we just make it more likely that there's going to be more military conflict in the world.
All right. Well, you make a very strong case for actually spending all this money on the military may actually be making us less safe, not more safe. I've been a little surprised in the federal government discussion in the presidential campaign. Hello? Yeah, I was a little surprised in the presidential campaign about people not really talking much about the military and the military spending and the issues around redeploying those funds for what we need here at home. What's been the response to your budget by the Democratic candidates for president or for Congress? Has anybody kind of picked up what you're saying? Have they been talking about it on the campaign trail, or how much support is your report getting?
Yeah, so last summer, the Poor People's Campaign had a big public forum with a bunch of the presidential candidates. At the time, there were, you know, over 20 candidates running in the Democratic primary. They invited all candidates, including the Republicans and President Trump, but only the Democratic candidates attended. There were nine of them who were attending that forum. and each of them were asked directly about how they would respond to different aspects of the moral budget, including military policy. And I think out of the nine who were there, seven were asked directly, like, would they cut the military budget? And seven of them, like all of them who were asked, agreed. And two of them who were not asked, are Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, had in other forums made statements saying that they would commit to military budget cuts. So I think of the candidates who are left now, Bernie Sanders is the one who I think has most consistently talked about redirecting funds from the military to other purposes, especially climate change. I believe that his platform calls for something like $80 billion a year to be redirected from the military budget to climate action. Elizabeth Warren, while she was in the race, also called for a similar amount in the context of Medicare for All. And I think they were two of the candidates that put a specific number on the amount that they would cut from the military budget. Others were, I think Tom Steyer had named a specific amount in the order of $90 to $100 billion. But we haven't heard specific numbers from others. So I think, that's what we've heard from candidates so far. But this is usually something that's framed in the context of how we pay for other programs, rather than, you know, making the case for, you know, the intrinsic value of reducing the military budget in the ways that we're saying are going to make our country safer and the world safer. So I think in general, we would definitely like to see a lot more discussion. At this point, it seems like, you know, the primary is playing out the way it's playing out. So as much as we've heard from some progressive candidates about this is perhaps as much as we're going to hear at this point in the cycle, we would love to hear more. this is just one of those things where there needs to be a lot more public discourse to make people aware of how much we're already spending in ways that misuse public money on the military budget, and how much that how important it is to start talking about redirecting it. So I think this is just going to be like a matter of raising public awareness and demand to really insist that our politicians respond to redirecting away from funds from harmful things toward things that actually make people's lives better.
Right. And in the meanwhile, we're going to have a big military budget no matter who's elected, it looks like. So how can we redirect the money that's at the military budget towards solving the climate crisis? And we just have about 1 minute to go here.
You know, I'll just bring it back to the big number I mentioned earlier, which is that it would cost $4.5 trillion over the course of 10 years to switch our entire energy system to renewable energy. That's $450 billion a year, which is a little bit more than the military cuts we're talking about, which is $350 billion a year. And this is really just a matter of Congress. Congress decides on a budget every year, and the president has to agree. So there's a lot of back and forth that happens over the course of months. So this is something that Congress has the power to budget. Like, they decide what to pay for. So there's been a lot of inertia in talking about the military budget. Like, usually there's just not a lot of public discussion about the fact that majorities of both parties just keep giving the Pentagon more and more money. So this is a place where, you know, if there was enough public pressure and politicians responded to that pressure, they could decide to simply give the Department of Defense less money and allocate more money to other social priorities.
Right, exactly. So if people want to learn more about the work that you're doing, how do they find out? Do you have a website, or where should they go?
Yeah, they should check out nationalpriorities.org. We have a bunch of reports that we put out. We have blog posts. We have tools on our website that lay out the trade-offs between the military budget and other aspects of our federal budget, and how much they would fund in other forms of social spending, like education, jobs and clean energy, people with healthcare, how many households could be funded with solar electricity or wind.
All right, great. Well, that's all the time we have. Ashiq Sadiq, thank you so much for being on All Together Now.
All right, thank you.
Our next guest is Rio Tazewell, Senior Campaigns Manager at People for the American Way, working on issues of democratic equality and social justice. He regularly coordinates advocacy campaigns to pressure Congress, federal agencies, the White House, state governments, and sometimes local municipalities to pass reforms protecting the interests of working people over the powerful and privileged. He represents People for the American Way in the coalition formed to pass major democracy reforms in Congress. Rio Tazewell, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks. Yeah, great to be with you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So I know you just finished another meeting on the Hill. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today. Can you tell our listeners who may not have heard about it, about this big democracy reform bill, H.R. 1, like what's in it and why should we care?
Yeah, absolutely. So almost 1 year ago exactly, the House of Representatives passed the most sweeping and substantive set of reforms to our democracy in terms of fighting corruption and creating a more equitable, transparent democracy that we've seen in decades, if not ever. And this bill, H.R. 1, for the People Act, includes a lot of different things that can go quite a long ways in terms of fixing the many problems that we see with our democracy. It expands and protects the right to vote. It addresses the influence of big money in politics, and it tackles a whole range of ethics and government issues. And yeah, it's been a huge collaboration of a broad coalition to bring it to bear in Congress, and it's been a close collaboration with us and then also leadership on the Democratic side to get it past the House. And we actually just celebrated the one-year anniversary this past Sunday, March 8th, was the exact one-year mark.
Yeah, well, happy anniversary. You know, it's impressive that a bill with so much sweeping reform, as you say, actually passed the U.S. House. And I believe it was the first bill that Nancy Pelosi passed when she resumed the Speaker's position. But that's no small feat to get that passed in the House. How did you build the support for that to pass so well?
Yeah, it certainly was quite a feat. As you mentioned, it was the first bill that Speaker Pelosi managed to get passed. And it was really the result of the blue wave that came in 2018 and the result of tireless efforts from grassroots activists all across the country, which were galvanized through this network of organizations that have come together under the banner of the Declaration for American Democracy, which is the coalition that has come together to now advance H.R. 1 for the People Act specifically, but before that was a thing to just generally advance systemic democracy reform. After the 2016 election, a network of groups came together to discuss how we can better coordinate our efforts to tackle the underlying systemic challenges like money in politics and voter suppression, but then also some of the flagrant abuses of power and attempts to undermine the rule of law that we've witnessed with this administration, and began organizing in early 2017 and putting together a broad package of reforms that we think are necessary to address the range of challenges that we see. And as the midterms approached, we began having conversations with then Leader Pelosi and others in Congress, particularly people like John Sarbanes from Maryland, who has been advocating for public financing of elections and other types of reforms, and really cobbled together quite a coalition of members of Congress that were working on different types of reforms in terms of voting rights and foreign interference in our elections and greater transparency in online political spending, and started having a conversation about what an omnibus-style large set of reforms could look like and would look like, and began building support well before the Democrats won the House in 2018. And then they did win the House. And at that point, we'd already established great contacts on the Hill in terms of advancing democracy reform. Pelosi was very much bought in at that time, and we had a great ongoing dialogue already across the coalition, which at that point had grown to almost 150 organizations that had come together. So we'd established contact across all of these groups, getting the leadership talking, coordinating our efforts on the grassroots front, which really began in earnest well before the election. We started having activists drop by in district offices, letting their members know that they wanted them to support systemic democracy reform, so that when the Democrats did come in January of last year, they had been hearing from their constituents for a while already that they wanted systemic democracy reform to be the number one priority. So when For the People got introduced as HR 1, we had already been building up a grassroots base that had been very active in terms of driving calls into Congress, dropping by, like I mentioned, in district all across the country, writing letters to the editor, doing lobby visits here in Washington, lighting up social media with pro-democracy reform content, and we were able to get every single Democrat to co-sponsor and vote for the bill, which is pretty extraordinary. And then we were able to get it introduced in the Senate as well, with all 47 Democratic senators co-sponsoring. So yeah, it's really been the result of a collaboration between this coalition and also Democratic leadership and the caucus at large.
That's a really impressive story to get 150 different organizations to kind of come together around one piece of legislation. How is that working out? Like, I assume some of these groups have very different or maybe occasionally competing interests, but it's the first time I've heard of all the democracy groups coming together. How's that working out?
Yeah, I mean, quite well. I've been a part of a number of coalitions in my career as an organizer, and I would say this has been one of the best ones in terms of how we work together. It started out as a fairly informal gathering of groups. You know, we began just having regular conference calls and discussing what a collaboration would look like, what an omnibus-style set of democracy reforms would look like, and gradually it became more of an established entity. But we operate democratically. We are obviously advocating for democracy, so we want to practice our principles. So we've generally operated by consensus. Whenever there's a decision, we try to hear everyone out and really try to take everyone's views into consideration. We've come a long way. I mean, now we're not just a smattering of groups that are working together anymore. The Declaration for American Democracy has managed to pull down some funding, which has allowed us to build a new website, which you can go to at declarationforamericandemocracy.org. It's allowed to fund some of the work that we're doing now, particularly in some target states. So we have money to subgrant to partners on the state level, and we've formed a campaign committee of about 20 different organizations that are particularly invested in the coalition, and have given a lot of equity and support in different forms to the coalition and are driving a lot of the work. But a lot of the effort happens through sub-working groups, actually. There's a number of different working groups that do, comms. We have a working group that does all of our communications, a grassroots mobilization working group, which I'm the co-chair of. And we have a policy working group, and then a Hill lobbying working group, and then a couple other working groups that tackle different aspects of the coalition, the work that we're doing. And it's just a matter of regularly coordinating across the different working groups and with the campaign committee to make sure that everyone knows what is on the agenda and hearing out any concerns that folks might have. But the fact that HR 1 picked up so much momentum was really a galvanizing force for us to put aside any differences that we might have in terms of differences of opinion around policy and whatnot, because it was so extraordinary just given the level of support we saw from Congress and the fact that it became the first bill, HR 1, and then, in the entire caucus getting on, it really made us realize that this was a huge opportunity for us to advance democracy reform, and that we should really all rally together. So we've managed to kind of keep that solidarity now, moving into 2020 towards the election later this year.
That's very impressive. I'm so heartened to hear it because, you know, as we know, every issue that we care about depends upon getting democracy reform, because every issue we care about is getting blocked in Congress, you know, and in somewhat at the state level due to the problems of voter suppression and gerrymandering and money in politics, that we're really not going to make as much success as we want in the other areas until we get number one democratic reforms in place that you've got in this wonderful bill that you've helped put together and pass. I find it fascinating you got every Democrat in the House to get behind it. How many Republicans in the House supported it? Any?
Unfortunately, no. No, we don't have a single Republican that has come on as a co-sponsor. There are Republicans that have supported different pieces of it as standalone bills, but as a broad package, no. There's unfortunately at this time no Republicans that have come out.
And it would seem to me this is really about America. That's, you know, if anything should be nonpartisan, it would be strengthening our democracy. So what's the rationale? Like, what are the excuses the Republicans give for not getting behind this?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I mean, Mitch McConnell has certainly had a lot to say about H.R. 1. He and others have called it a power grab, which is ironic because it is a form of a power grab. It grabs power back from wealthy corporate interests and into the hands of people. We're really trying to retilt the scales of democracy back towards we the people, because there's been such an incredible concentration of wealth and political power in this country over recent decades. There very much is a need for a recalibration, and this is an attempt to do that. So, I mean, there are people like Mitch McConnell that have bluntly stated that they think there should be more money in politics rather than less. And then there are other Republicans that just quibble around the edges about this or that, and say they would support it if it wasn't for this one thing, or they would support it if it wasn't for that one thing. But at the end of the day, I think it's just partisanship. I think the Democrats, or the Republicans rather, feel vulnerable and exposed if they were to support it. They would get primaried from the right. Mitch McConnell wouldn't approve, and they would have people in their own party attacking them for supporting it, even though the majority of Americans across the political spectrum support these types of reforms. These reforms are very bipartisan in terms of what people want. And outside of Washington, these things are not particularly contentious, but unfortunately in D.C. it has become a very partisan issue in terms of advancing democracy reform.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly become clear to a lot of Americans that we have to address this whole efforts around to suppress the vote and the flood of big money on our elections. I mean, people are very concerned about the influence that the big money has had in the different ways. So it's great that you're doing it. It's great that the Democrats have gotten behind it, and Nancy Pelosi as Speaker put her clout behind it. So it passed the House with flying colors, but then of course got sent over to the Senate, which is controlled by Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell, and they call it now the Senate graveyard over there, Mitch McConnell's graveyard. What do we need to do, or what can we do to pass this bill in the Senate?
Yeah, so that is a very important question, and that's what we've been working on with the Declaration for American Democracy, pivoting to some key states where there are Republicans that are up for re-election in the Senate that are considered vulnerable this year, so that we can hopefully win a majority in the Senate and hopefully get it passed. So we're investing and organizing in states like Arizona and Colorado and Maine and North Carolina and Georgia, all of which have Senate races. And as I mentioned earlier, the coalition's managed to raise some funding that we're able to subgrant to partners in those states that are doing democracy work. Some of those states actually have state-level reforms that are moving forward as well. So we're working with our partners to both advance that state-level work, but then also engage in the Senate races in those states, and then also build support and public awareness for the People Act, so that if and when the Democrats can win a majority in the Senate next year and hold on to the House, and hopefully win the White House, there will be a trifecta in which the For the People Act could be signed into law as early as next year. But a lot of things would have to go right. There's, you know, obviously an uphill climb no matter what, but there is a path forward to getting it passed the Senate and signed into law as early as 2021.
Yeah, and what are the key states? I would assume, you know, there is a pathway. More Republicans are up for election this year than Democrats from the Senate. Which states do you think we have a shot at changing over to people who are, you know, pro-democracy candidates that we could get into the state, into the U.S. Senate?
Yeah, so the states that we're focusing on with the coalition are Arizona, Colorado, Maine, Georgia, and North Carolina. And those are the five states that we're sub-granting money to and actively working with partners on the ground. There are a number of other states that various groups in the coalition are also working on. It's important to note that some groups in the Declaration for American Democracy are just 501c3 and therefore can't do electoral work directly. They can do general public awareness and engagement around the democracy reforms that we're working on. But then there are a number of groups, including People for the American Way, where I work, that are able to do electoral work through our 501c4 parts. And the coalition is comprised of both of those groups. So we are very much getting involved as a coalition, and different groups are getting involved on the electoral side in those and other states. But those five are the ones that the coalition's focusing on: Arizona, Colorado, Maine, Georgia, North Carolina.
Fantastic. And you mentioned that you're co-chair of the Grassroots Mobilization Working Group. What's the focus of that grassroots mobilization right now? Is it to focus on those five states and try to get the pro-democracy senators elected in those states so we can pass this bill, or what's your priority?
That will become the priority, and it already has been. We're in the process of working with partners on the ground to develop proposals that we'll take to the broader coalition in terms of sub-granting resources. But then those resources will be spent to execute campaign plans that involve different actions and efforts in each of those states. So we're actively moving towards pivoting fully to state focus work, for the most part at least. But then we actually just wrapped up a big grassroots effort around the anniversary of HR1, since that was just this past Sunday. So there was a few things that we did with our grassroots partners. We actually just had a webinar training for activists on Sunday on the anniversary that night, where we had Congressman Sarbanes on, who, as I mentioned, is the chief architect or one of the chief architects in the House for HR1. And then we had a few of our advocacy and organizing partners on, talking about a number of actions that we're encouraging people to take, including doing in-district drop-bys, thanking members that co-sponsored HR1 for their vote, and then obviously putting pressure on those that haven't, writing letters to the editor, and then also calling. So mostly thanking those members that supported it and reminding them that there's a large and growing movement around this set of reforms, but then also going a little bit further in a few districts where there are some pieces of legislation that are tied to HR1 that have to be passed separately that still have yet to get the full Democratic caucus on board. One in particular is HJ Res 2. It's a proposed constitutional amendment to overturn Supreme Court cases like Citizens United. And the Democracy for All amendment would basically allow for reasonable limits to be put on raising and spending of money in politics, whereas because of Citizens United, anything that was passed by Congress or state legislatures that would limit campaign spending, outside campaign spending by super PACs and 501c4s, would be found unconstitutional and struck down because of Supreme Court cases like Citizens United and others going back to 1976 with Buckley v. Valeo. So basically there needs to be a constitutional amendment to really adequately address the issue of money in politics. And For the People Act is emerging as the Democracy for All Amendment, rather, is emerging as the consensus amendment. And we actually have almost the whole caucus on board. There's only 16 members of the House Democratic Caucus that have yet to get on board. So that was one of the things that we were talking about on this activist training on Sunday, was the need to get those last 16 members on so that we can hopefully get a floor vote before the end of the year. And then also talking about other things that are in H.R. 1, including D.C. statehood. There were findings included in H.R. 1 about the need for the District of Columbia to be given full state status, because there are 700,000 people that live here. They don't have any voting representation in Congress, even though we pay the highest in taxes per capita of anyone in the country. We don't have any real voting representation in Congress. So there are other measures like that in H.R. 1 where there are findings about different issues, like the need for an amendment, like the need for statehood for D.C., that had to be introduced separately just because of the nature of the reform. So we're still working on those individual pieces, and we'll be doing a lot of grassroots organizing around those things as well.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. Well, what can our listeners do? I know everyone listening is concerned about the state of our democracy, and we know we need to change some of the rules to, as you say, bring the power back to the people. What could our listeners do to support these democracy reforms?
Yeah, well, if you want to learn more about the Declaration for American Democracy, definitely go to our website. It's just declarationforamericandemocracy.org, spelled out. And you can learn all of the things that we're up to, learn about them. If you're interested in the group that I work for, People for the American Way, definitely go to our website. It's pfaw.org. And democracy work is a big part of what we're doing, but we work on a whole range of progressive issues. A lot of our work is more important now than ever. We work on everything from immigration to women's rights to racial justice to the federal judiciary and judicial nominations. So there's obviously a lot happening. So if you're interested in any of that or any other really topical domestic progressive issues, we're probably working on it, so you can check that out at pfaw.org. And then the Declaration for American Democracy will be championing H.R. 1 moving into the election and hopefully into a democratically controlled House, Senate, and White House next year.
Yeah, very good. And Rio, you are right in the middle of this battle for democracy. How are you feeling about it? You're here in D.C. I don't know when you came. You probably came around the time. Certainly been here for several years with mm-hmm. Trump in the White House. It must feel a little bit like an uphill slog, but how hopeful are you feeling that we're going to make some of these needed changes to reduce the influence of money in politics and reclaim our right to vote?
Yeah, I'm actually feeling very hopeful. I mean, there are so many organizations that have so many millions of members all across the country that are really concerned about these issues and really understand what's at stake and what can be done to address these systemic challenges. So I feel like through continued collaboration, we can really turn the page on this and see some real reforms pass and see some real changes enacted and some real progress on these issues, which in turn can create the opportunity to make progress on any number of other issues, whether it's access to healthcare or addressing climate change or addressing the epidemic of gun violence. There are so many issues that are tied into having a dysfunctional democracy. And then I think that would in turn inspire more people to get involved with the political process. So I think that if we can keep moving the ball on this democracy reform work, that it can have a ripple effect and create positive change in so many other areas of politics in our country in general. So I'm feeling optimistic, but also very realistic about what we're up against. And it's very sobering just to witness what's happening on a day-to-day basis. And by no means can we take anything for granted. But just based off what I've seen come together in the past few years, I'm very optimistic that we can get this thing done, but it does take continued involvement by anyone and everyone that's aware of this and educating people that are not yet aware.
Right, fantastic. Well, I appreciate everything you're doing. And again, for our listeners, that website is declarationforamericandemocracy.org. Check it out, get involved, do what you can to help reclaim power to the people in the United States. That's all the time we have. Rio Tazewell, thank you so much for your important work and for being with us on All Together Now.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks for having me.